All right, Revelation chapter 9, chapter 8, to recall, we had last Sabbath, ended with an eagle, not an angel, but an eagle, flying high and wide over the world, crying, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. In other words, seven of these trumpets and four of them have already been blown in chapter 8, but the three that are left to be blown are worse. The worst is yet to come. This brings us to the beginning of chapter 9, and here we have the fifth angel sounds his trumpet. You realize that in the Bible, trumpets are commonly warnings. We noted that in Ezekiel. A watchman must blow the trumpet to warn. These are partial visitations of the righteous judgment of God upon a wicked world, but they're not absolute judgment. That comes only later. But there are still warnings here. And so the intent of these is to warn people and to motivate them to repent and turn back to God. And you'll see at the end of the chapter, it's noted that people have failed to do so, but this is the intent of the warning. Now, the fifth angel sounds, chapter 9, verse 1, and John in his vision sees a star fall onto the earth. And this, I take it, stands for Satan. You know, another name of Satan is Lucifer. Morning star, Lucifer, bringer of light. He was an angel of light before he fell into sin and became the great enemy of God. And here he is pictured as falling from heaven onto this earth. Now this recalls a statement of Jesus that we should surely read in this connection. The book of Luke, chapter 10, verse 18. The disciples, part of them, or all of the 12 apostles, had been out on a preaching mission and had performed miracles as commanded by Jesus and had cast out spirits and healed the sick and so on. And they came back to very joyful and exultant that this kind of power had been committed then. Even the devils are subject to us in your name. And Jesus here in John, in Luke rather, 10:18, this is another account of that same occasion, says, verse 18, and he said unto them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Goes on and tells the disciples, don't be so happy that the demons are subject to you, but rather because your names are written in heaven. It's a better cause for rejoicing. But Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Now this, of course, is all of it figurative language. But this means that this is the present status of Satan. Through the redemptive work of Christ, his perfect life, his substitutionary and sacrificial death, and his resurrection, Satan has lost the last square inch of standing ground in heaven. Back in the Old Testament, you find Satan appearing among the sons of God, and he comes to accuse Job. And now Satan has been, you see, he engineered the crucifixion of Christ. Jesus said, this is the hour of the power of darkness. But Satan is never quite intelligent enough to war with God. And the very thing that he thought was a master stroke to put the plan of God out of business has always turned out to be itself a piece in God's great jigsaw puzzle. and it marks the doom of Satan. So Jesus said, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. From the time of Jesus Christ, and this means, of course, his crucifixion and resurrection here, the crisis time, Satan is doomed. Now he's still somewhat on the loose, but strictly limited by God. And he is the champion of a lost cause. And also he knows this. Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Now, God permits Satan and evil spirits to do some things. And as noted here on the blackboard, you can look at this from two viewpoints. You can see these terrible calamities and atrocities and so forth as acts of Satan. And in this aspect, of course, they are unbelievably wicked. On the other hand, none of this happens apart from the permissive decree or permission of God. Satan cannot do anything on his own. Even back there in the Old Testament, he could not do anything to Job and Job's family until he got a clearance from God. And he had to get permission. And so you could say that these evils that fall upon the world, that become so increasingly terrible as we read about them, are not only acts of the wickedness and malice of Satan, but they are also parts of God's moral government of the world by which he is accomplishing a purpose which will finally be fully accomplished, and Satan will finally lose the great cosmic chess game, and he will lose out on that. Now, it says that it was given to him the key of the bottomless pit. This is hell. He doesn't have this key to open this and turn these forces loose on the world of himself. It was given to him the key of the bottomless pit. Now remember, of course, this is a vision. Satan doesn't go around carrying a key to a literal pit that you could unlock a padlock on it or something like that. That would be to misread the whole thing. It is figurative language, and yet it is the statement, on the other hand, of absolute truth. John sees it as a vision. And yet what is represented by the vision is true and real. Dr. Hendrickson says, Satan receives power to open the abyss and let the demons out and turn these hellish spirits loose among the unbelieving and unchristian people of the world. Now, the abyss, or the bottomless pit, is the name used in the Bible for hell before the judgment day. We could look at Luke chapter 8, verse 31. You'll see there that evil spirits cast out of somebody by Jesus didn't want to be sent back to the abyss. Luke 8, 31. This is the man that had many devils and whose name was called Legion. And Jesus drove these out and restored him to a normal condition. 31, and they besought him that he would not command them to go out into the deep. That's the abyss. Called here in Revelation the bottomless pit. That's a name for hell. And in Revelation chapter 20, in the first three verses of that chapter, I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And in verse 3 again, the bottomless pit. Now, after the judgment day, hell is no longer called the bottomless pit. After this, it is called the lake of fire. Revelation 20, verses 14 and 15, death and hell, that is, death and Hades, were cast into the lake of fire, this is the second death, and whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. This is what hell is called after the great judgment day. But before that, it is not spoken of as the lake of fire, but as the abyss, bottomless pit. Now, Satan, by being permitted by God to unlock the abyss and let these forces out, incites the world to evil. He fills the world with invisible, wicked spirits that cannot touch or harm you and me, but which certainly affects wicked people. Satan has been called the prince of this world, the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience, the sons of disobedience, and so on. He is permitted by God to have a terrible, malignant influence upon people who are not Christians, who have not been sealed and who have not been marked off as those who really belong to God. Now, the world is filled then in a way that it previously was not. You know, we can see this in our own world of today. Wickedness is becoming bolder in many of its many different aspects and faces. The devil is getting over his inferiority complex. Now, maybe that is with the desperation of cornered wild beast that knows it's all up. But in any case, you can see evil getting bolder and more desperate. And things that even non-Christians would have been ashamed of in our grandparents' day, maybe when we were young, long, long ago, you know, people today are not even ashamed of. They just live that way. So there is an increasing and increasingly obvious activity of Satan. You don't see the devil. Least of all, you don't see him in the cartoon idea, going around with a pitchfork and, you know, and belching smoke. This is not what you'll see. But the devil is seen by his footprints, as God is seen by his footprints in the world. And you see what the devil has done in the world and what he is doing. Now, as the abyss is opened, there's a great plume of foul, black, dirty smoke comes out. Black smoke. And it darkens the sun and it clouds the earth. Foul smoke. It says like the smoke of a great furnace. Dr. Hendrickson paraphrases this, the smoke of deception and delusion, of sin and sorrow, of moral darkness and degradation that is constantly pouring up out of hell. You know, I don't think Aliquippa is hell, but you drive down the Ohio River Boulevard sometimes and see what's coming out of some of those steel mill smokestacks on the west side of the river and sometimes on the east side. You wonder, are they doing what they can to avoid polluting the atmosphere that we breathe? They've been given a time limit to clean that up. Well, anybody here live in Aliquippa? That's, of course, merely physical pollution of the atmosphere. There's nothing particularly hellish about that. But it becomes an image, you see, a figure for it. I confess I sort of choke on it a little. I shut the car windows, you know, and go past that on some days when that's sort of hanging low there. Well, this great cloud of foul smoke standing here for moral and spiritual smoke and confusion and evil. It blots out the sun and darkens the air. Now notice, the power to do this is given to the devil. That is, it is included in the providence and the permissive decree of God. Otherwise, Satan could not do it. He would if he could, but he couldn't unless God permitted it. He is permitted, that is, he is not prevented. God is almighty and could prevent this, but for reasons of his own, he does not. He's not prevented from corrupting the world and men's minds and hearts. And yet, and here we enter the realm of mystery, Satan and not God is responsible for all this. Do not blame anything on God. God is not tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. We are tempted by our own sinful nature. Now, this is one of the trumpets that is a warning to people to repent, as shown by the last verse of this chapter. Now, chapter 9, verse 3, out of the smoke come locusts, and they have power to bite and wound like scorpions. The picture that I passed around shows what locusts did to a fig tree. But these locusts are not insect locusts. These are human locusts and hellish locusts. They are commanded not to hurt the trees and the vegetation. Now, a locust that will not hurt trees or vegetation is very different from the natural locusts of Palestine. They are to hurt men, those men that have not the seal of God in their forest. Now, in Bible land, the locusts were and still are a terrible plague. A description of this is given in the Old Testament, Book of Joel, chapter 1, verses 6 to 12. Under the image of an army invading the country, these locusts come in by the million, and when they get through, they just go like a wave over the country, like you'd run a vacuum sweeper over a carpet. And when they get through, there isn't a blade of grass or a leaf on a tree or any living thing of the way of vegetation that is left. Now let's see. Hosea, Joel, here we are. Chapter 1, verses 6 to 12. For a nation has come up upon my land, strong and without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he hath the cheek teeth of a great lion. He hath laid my vine waste, and barked my fig tree. He hath made it clean bare, and cast it away. The branches thereof are made white. Lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. The meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord. They don't even have anything for sacramental purposes. It's all gone. The priests, the Lord's ministers, mourn. The field is wasted. The land mourneth, for the corn is wasted. The new wine is dried up. The oil languishes. Be ashamed, O ye husbandmen. Howl, O ye vine dressers, for the wheat and for the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished. The vine is dried up, the fig tree languishes, the pomegranate tree, the palm tree also, and the apple tree, even all the trees of the field are withered, because joy is withered away from the sons of men. Now this probably back there in Joel was describing a literal plague of locusts, I mean real insect locusts that flew in and destroyed all the crops and all the vegetation. But here in Revelation, it is used as a figure or an image for spirit realities that are equally real, but not so visible, that corrupt and ruin the world. The powers, Hendrickson says, and influences of hell operating in the hearts and the lives of wicked men. Notice they harm only those men that have not been sealed by the seal of God. These are the group we read about in chapter 7, verses 1 to 8. And it says also that this plague of, let's say, hellish locusts is limited in its duration to 5 months. Now, nobody that I know of or have read anything by knows what that 5 months means. All sorts of speculative answers. You know, in medicine, when you find 50 remedies recommended for something, it's a pretty sure thing none of them work. There used to be that many remedies for malaria, and there weren't any of them effective, and then quinine was discovered, and this really stops malaria in its tracks, and all the snake root oil and everything else sort of faded out after that. So when you find many very different interpretations of a thing like this, it's a pretty fair guess to start with that none of them is right. At least that not more than one of them is right, and maybe not even that many. So this 5 months, nobody has come up with a convincing real explanation of why 5 months. Why is it 5 months, not 4 months, or 4.5, or 6, or 6.5? Why is it 5 months? And I think the only thing we can say about this is that, like some things in the parables of Jesus, this is part of the stage setting. And if we want to assign a meaning to it, it is not specific. This would mean that it is a definite but comparatively short time. This is not permanent. It doesn't go on and on and on indefinitely, but just stop. And then there would be a period that would be better, perhaps, and then it would come again. Now, back in the book of Judges, you read the terrible things in the book of Judges. You might get the idea they had nothing but war and atrocity and calamity and so forth in the 350 years or so of the book of Judges. But this would be a misreading of it. You read about one of these terrible campaigns, and a little statement, the land had rest. 40 years. You read some more. Another terrible stormy scene, land had rest. 80 years. So there are periods between in which this lets up, and that may be the idea suggested by this 5 months affair. Now, I take it all these things that we're reading about here in these chapters happen over and over again during the whole period between Christ's ascension to heaven and his second coming. But perhaps when we have said that, we should also admit that these may happen with increasing severity and increasing intensity as time goes on. So that toward the end of this age of God's plan, these things may be more obvious, more visible, more intense, and more terrible than they were before. Now, it says in chapter 9, verse 5, the end of chapter verse 5, as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. Any of you ever get bitten by a scorpion? Well, how about a rattlesnake? Black widow spider. That's pretty deadly, isn't it? A scorpion, I believe the bite does not usually cause death, but it is extremely painful. They look like a small lobster, and they can sting you worse than a whole hive of bees, I guess, terribly, and they're very, very painful for a long time, bite of a scorpion. So they were feared by everybody back in the Old Testament, in the Bible times, in the land of Palestine. The bite has from a stinger in its tail, which contains a powerful poison. It is said that they have even been rated as more, let's say, poisonous than several species of poisonous snakes, the desert vipers that occur in Palestine. And this is so painful and destructive that men would prefer to die. They would rather be dead and unable to die, seek death and find it not. And that's in verse 6. In those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. Now, I suppose it's always possible to commit suicide in some way or other, but this is a way of intensifying and bringing out the intensity of the painfulness and the grievous character and destructiveness of this visitation here. Now, in chapter 9, from verses 7 to 10, we have a description of these hellish locusts. Remember, they aren't insects. They're demonized people. who are being maneuvered around and brainwashed by Satan, the god of this world. They look like horses prepared for battle. They have crowns, as it were, of gold. Christ has a crown that's of real gold. They have crowns of synthetic or imitation gold, if there is such a thing, like the diamond rings that you can buy down at Mercy. They will fool a three-year-old into thinking they've got a diamond ring, but won't anybody give any one of those things to the girl they hope to marry? Bad policy. Now, as it were of gold. See, everything about Satan has the mark of counterfeit on it, or imitation. It isn't so genuine. Faces are human, and hair as of women. I take it this is very long hair, maybe waist long, and perhaps the flowing behind them in the breeze. Teeth like those of lions, breastplates as of iron, and they sound like chariots and many horses running to battle. I suppose if John had been writing this today instead of long ago on the island of Patmos, he'd have said it sounds like the roar of jet planes landing and taking off. Something like that. A terrific noise. Horses and many chariots running to battle. And they have scorpion-like things in their tails, and we're told again now that they have power to hurt men. 5 months, it was painful and burning, but not of itself fatal. Striking terror, however, into men's hearts and banishing hope far beyond over the horizon. The operation of the powers of darkness in the souls of wicked men during this age. Now, you should realize that those in whom the work of Satan is most extreme and most real are the least aware of it, and think they are only humans with human plans. Most of them, for instance, atheists, there's no atheist who believes in God, and there's no atheist who believes in the devil. And yet he can do the devil's work more effectively and if he were a covenantist. You know, they're no good at the devil's work. But the atheist and the disbeliever in the existence of Satan, you see, Satan can hide behind this disguise, and something can be put across as any wise human plan when actually it was hatched in hell. And people don't even realize it. Now, it says they have a ruler over the bottomless pit, and his name is given here, the angel of the bottomless pit. This is, of course, the devil or Satan, the god of this world, the prince of this world, and so on, and so named other places in the Bible. And he gives his name in two languages here. In Hebrew it is Abaddon, and in Greek it is Apollyon. Apolluon, Apollyon, which is both of these mean the same thing, the destroyer. Satan is never creative, only destructive. God creates, and Satan seeks to destroy. Destructive. The sixth angel now sounds his trumpet. Well, verse 13. And here we see something now from God's standpoint. The sixth angel, verse 12, verses announcing. One woe is past, there come two more woes thereafter. Verse 13, the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God. So God is going to step in and do something. We see something to happen now, not simply as a series of hellish acts of Satan, but something of what God intends by all this, and how God is working either through this or against it or over it to accomplish His purpose. Now, this verse 13, I take it, speaks of the a voice from the four horns of the golden altar before God. This recalls us back to chapter 8, verses 3 and 4, where we read about the prayers of the saints. Chapter 8, 3, another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came up with the prayers of the saints ascended up to God out of the angel's hand. You have two kinds of smoke here. There's the sweet-smelling, fragrant smoke of the incense that stands for Christ's heavenly intercession as our advocate, that is mixed in with the prayers, the imperfect prayers of Christian people, and rises up before God perfectly pleasing and acceptable to him through Christ's intercession being mixed with it. This is one kind of smoke. The other is the foul, black, hellish smoke that comes out of the bottom of the pit. This is just the opposite, of course. It has a different source and a different purpose and a different meaning. Now, at this point, this angel, speaking from between or near the four horns of the golden altar, says to the sixth angel, which has the trumpet. This is the time for the sixth trumpet to be blown now. Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Now, the Euphrates is one of the great rivers of the world, and especially in Bible history. It flows through Iraq and down to the Persian Gulf. That's, I believe, in what is today Turkey. A very great river. The Euphrates and parallel to it, the Tigris, and they come together just a little, a few miles before it finally runs out into the ocean. And two great empires that were utterly against God and contrary to God's people and were used as instruments of judgment by God in Old Testament times were located on those rivers, especially Babylon on the Euphrates, Assyria on the Tigris, but holding an empire that included both. So Assyria and Babylon, or Babylonia, both of these originally powerful military dictatorships and world empires, but which became symbols of the anti-God movement in the world. The world viewed as evil and as anti-God, the world system as opposed to God. You know, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world made as well therein. But there is a sense in which the term world is used in the Bible as something bad, and that's, for instance, when Jesus called Satan the prince of this world, or when he's called the god of this world. There is a system that is anti-God in the world, that is struggling against God and against the work of God in the world, and this is symbolized here by the great heathen, powerful military empires of Old Testament times, Assyria and Babylonia, and the word Euphrates is the key to this. And these angels are said to be bound in the river Euphrates. Now, please note in the first place, these are not the same four angels that we had before. We had in chapter 7, verse 1, it speaks of four angels at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth. Those are holy angels used by God to, let's say, hold the status quo for a while and prevent evil from bursting out and flooding the world without limits and too soon. Holy angels. But these in chapter 9 are evil angels. These are demons, or evil spirits, as shown by what they do. They are devils or evil spirits. Now, the Euphrates, standing for the anti-God system, and these angels that have been holding this power in restraint, that have been held in restraint, now are to be released so that they can turn this torrent of woe and trouble loose upon the world. I take it this predicts war, certainly, not one particular war, but all wars, and especially all world wars, and the increasing world conflict which may occur in future times until the judgment day comes. Now here, war is a punishment permitted by God to the world, and it is also a warning to unbelievers and wicked men. These four angels that have been under some restraint, you see, while there was a kind of comparative world peace for a long time, and it comes and goes, these angels were under restraint, but are these devils, but are now to be released, and they're glad to plunge mankind into war. You have read C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, his first religious book. You will recall that Screwtape and Wormwood discussed wicked people that are going to go to hell, and the devil says to his apprentice, "There are meat. What else have we got to eat but the souls of these people?" And they delight in causing suffering and pain and in destroying that which is beautiful and lovely and clean and pure. Everything they want to destroy and make foul and vile like themselves. This is their nature and their fallen condition. Still, they can do nothing until and unless God permits it. War is turned loose on the world, and we've seen two of them in our own lifetime, World War I, World War II, 1914 to 18 and 39 to 45. But it cannot happen any time in history without the permission of God. And this is shown by the fact that these angels have been restrained in the Euphrates until the day and the hour and the month and the year. It is permitted by God. It is under His control. It cannot happen until God gives them the green light to do it. Now, the number is terrifying. You can't imagine a number like this unless you're a mathematician. Mr. Schaefer, can you imagine in your mind, get a visual image of 200 million? What's the present population of the United States? Is it over 200 million? A little over, huh? 210 million, something like this. And increasing fairly rapidly. A little kid in China said to a teacher, "Isn't it true, teacher, the population of China is 600 million? "Yeah, that's right." "No, it isn't. I had a baby brother born last night. 600 million and one. Now, 200 million, you see, a million is 1,000,000. And here are 200 times 1,000 times 1,000. This is an army such as the world never saw. This figure, of course, is a symbolical number here, but it is intended to impress on us the vast number of the forces that are under the dominion of Satan and opposed to the rule of God. 200 million. And their sole purpose is to destroy. Now, verse 17, we read something about the description of these. And Hendrickson says it is a description they're called locusts, but read about their features, breastplates of iron and so forth, and you can't help but thinking of modern artillery and aircraft and the instruments of destruction that are available in the world today. And some of the worst of them invented since Hendrickson's book was written, too. 17. "Thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, and adjacent and brimstone," that's sulfur. "And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone." By these three was a third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. The power is in their mouth and in their tails. Their tails were like unto serpents and had heads in which end did they hurt. And so on. Now, I suppose some of you read Time magazine, and there was an article in there a week ago. I think not in the one that came this last week, but the one before, on the potential use of laser beams in warfare. Enough to make your blood run cold, just to read it. You can get somebody in the sight of a laser beam and at a distance of 3 to 5 miles, turn this thing on, and the fluid inside his eye will boil and burst his eyeball. And it will also bore a 1/4-inch hole right through a person at a distance of 3 to 5 miles. And of course, that's fatal. The power that is in human hands and the destruction that this could wreak, if not restrained in some way, is just almost past belief. Now, riding up to Wampum to a wedding yesterday, and I saw a sign on a billboard that says, "You've come a long way, baby." You may recognize those words I heard on the TV, from Adam's rib to women's lips. But you could say that, I don't know that I buy that, but you could say that warfare has come a long way since people fought with bows and arrows. I saw a cartoon in that classic and highly sophisticated journal, The Mad Comics, of a caveman out in front of his cave, and another one comes along and says, "Tell me, brontosaur chopper, do you really believe that the stone axe is the ultimate weapon?" Well, the stone axe is the ultimate weapon until somebody invents something that is ultimater than the stone axe, more ultimate. But these weapons that are symbolized here are something vastly more terrible and deadly than anything in Bible times, when fighting was done with bows and arrows and with swords and spears and throwing rocks at people and things like this. And surely it pictures an intensifying of the plagues and calamities, and especially war, that come upon a world and are permitted by God to come upon a world that rejects the rider on the white horse, which is Christ. Now, the persecuting world has become here the impenitent world. God allows these terrible things to happen in partial judgment of a world that crucified his Son and slaughtered his saints. God is not blind, neither is he deaf. He is under in control of this, and the blood of the martyrs is precious in his sight. Now, we live in what is being called a post-Christian world, is it? Well, I'm not ready to admit this absolutely, but something to it. There was also an article in Christianity Today, last issue but one, on Sweden. Hope none of you are Swedish, because if you are, you have my sympathy. Sweden is going back to a devilish paganism. Christianity is almost fading out of the life of the country of